one fundamental difference is a totally different understanding of what is meant by grace. According to Holy Scripture and our confessions, saving grace is not something, some power in us, or something producing good works, but saving grace is God's undeserved free favor in Christ. It's an attitude in Him. St. Paul makes that very clear in several texts, for example, Romans 4 and 11 and so on. Rome, on the other hand, defined grace as a kind of spiritual energy poured into human beings, which enable them to do good works, which in turn merit salvation.
The familiar voice of Kurt Marquardt, a regular guest here on Issues, etc., served for many years as a professor at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. He died this morning, called home to his eternal rest, and we're joined here for the next few minutes of Issues, etc., by his pastor, Pastor David Peterson, also a regular guest here on the program, pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Marquardt was a member at Redeemer Lutheran Church. Pastor Peterson, welcome back to Issues, etc.
Thanks, Todd.
What is it like to pastor this church in Fort Wayne and to look out on a Sunday morning from the altar, from the pulpit, into the eyes of a theological giant like Kurt Marquardt?
Well, it was very easy. He made it very easy. At first, to be sure, when I was first called here, it was extremely intimidating. But he just was such a gentle and forgiving and encouraging soul that he was the easiest member I've ever had.
How is the Marquardt family doing?
I think they're doing well. They do not mourn like those who have no hope. So they are most certainly sad, but they expect to see him again.
And I understand that Kurt was teaching from a wheelchair with a microphone, suffering from Lou Gehrig's disease, up until Friday last week. Is that correct?
Right. And I think that as awful as the disease was, the Lord was merciful to Kurt, and he lived a very full life right up to the end. He taught on Friday, and he even you may have read as well, he even baptized his great grandchild last night. So he wasn't in bed. He did pass away in bed, but he didn't go to bed until probably 8:30, 9 o'clock last night, and he didn't spend his last months in that kind of a way. And we're thankful for that.
He only discovered that he had Lou Gehrig's. Golly, it wasn't even a year ago. Is that correct?
I think it was about Christmas last year. So 9 months ago.
Were there signs of the disease even before the family discovered what it was?
Well, I don't know. I suppose in hindsight, you know, everybody can always say, "Oh, sure," but no, I don't think there was real obvious things. He was a very he'd suffered a lot in his life and his childhood and so forth, so he was tougher than us soft Americans, you know.
How would you? He wrote so much. He, as I said before, I think considered a giant in Lutheran theology. How would you characterize Kurt Marquardt's theology?
Well, it was crystal clear, always concise, and always extremely evangelical. He was, in fact, I was quite shocked once in a while when I would hear the strangest things about Kurt Marquardt. Sometimes he would have the most bizarre reputation because he was so stalwart. Somehow people who'd never met him and apparently never read anything he'd written had this idea that he was this harsh man. And, I mean, anything you read, he's just, the gospel just oozes. He was all about the forgiveness of sins and reconciliation in Jesus Christ and the grace of God.
So what is with that, that those who are concerned about doctrine, like Dr. Marquardt certainly was, gained this reputation for somehow being harsh when, in fact, they are far from being harsh in their writing or in their person. How is that, Pastor Peterson?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's a bit like when you call a drunk a drunk, he has a tendency to get angry with you. If you call a man who has no struggle with this and no signs of this in his life a drunk, he'll just say, "What do you mean?" Or maybe laugh. I think Kurt Marquardt had a way of really getting to the heart of things. And even though he was, he really was always so kind and gentle, he would get at the heart of things in a way that I think people found sometimes uncomfortable.
I think the first time I saw Kurt in person was at some sort of church function, big church organization function, and he was dressed in, I think, African, some kind of African garb, which really stood out because he was quite gray-haired white man. Talk about his mission emphasis, if you would.
Well, he certainly had a heart for sort of what we would have called at one point the third world, developing countries, and the sort of reemerging churches, both in the former Soviet Union and also in Africa and particularly in Haiti. He always identified with those who were oppressed. He grew up and he was born in Estonia, and I don't know if I can get all of the chronology correct, but he spent some time in World War II as a child, running from both the Bolsheviks or the Stalinists, and also the Nazis. And then, by God's grace, was in the part of Germany where they were hiding that was occupied by the British. So he always identified very strongly with those who were oppressed in any way.
One of the first writings of his, I did not attend Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, but one of the first writings of his that really caught my attention was a very early warning on the issue of church growth.
Yes.
And I have got to say, that document that he wrote of his own volition pretty much serves still to this day for me personally as the outline of my critique of that movement in the church. Talk about it if you would, Pastor.
Right. Well, I think it's definitely a very precise critique of the problems with sort of church growth methodology, not meaning, of course, that Kurt Marquardt or any of us is against the church growing, but against that particular methodology of using marketing techniques and emotional manipulation to try to make the church grow rather than the preaching of the pure gospel. It's a very precise critique of that without getting into personalities and, you know, insults and name-calling. But I think also in that document, the reason you probably love it so much, and the reason I do, is that once again, throughout the thing, on every page, there is this proclamation of who God is for us in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. I mean, don't you think that's fair?
Yeah.
He's always talking about that.
He seemed to have the ability to do those two things, to look ahead at the possible dangers that a movement like that would present to the church before others really sensed those dangers, and to come to the, as I would say, the bottom line
right.
of how the gospel of Jesus Christ really is at stake in those issues.
Right, absolutely. For Kurt, it was always about the gospel, nothing else. I mean, there is nothing else. It is the gospel, and if there is something else, and it isn't related in some way, then it's truly adiaphora. That is, it's truly something that's neither commanded nor forbidden and upon which we are free. And I think you mentioned his clothing. He did dress sometimes in rather unconventional ways, and sometimes to the amusement, sometimes to the chagrin of those who were close to him. I think even that was an identification with those who were oppressed, and also a certain calling of all of us to sort of take stock and not to become sort of falsely institutionalized, or to think that, you know, clothing make the man and that sort of thing. He was pretty harsh as well in his critique of even sort of overly fancy liturgical forms, in the same kind of way, even though this congregation, which he was extremely faithful and loved, is the most sort of liturgical or ceremonial congregation, probably just about in the synod. And yet, you know, he was always very aware of, you know, what might get in the way.
What was his concern there?
Well, I don't think it was a concern with Redeemer per se. I think it was always a concern, rightly, that we always need that balance. That while ceremonies have their place, at the same time, we never want to have them become elevated to the point that we think the ceremony is either a mark of orthodoxy or that the ceremony is somehow meriting favor with God.
One other thing that struck me in my brief acquaintances with Kurt Marquardt was a sense of churchmanship. Mm-hmm. And one can hardly serve as a teacher at the seminary and lack this, but he seemed to have it. Not always given credit for having this sense of good, solid scriptural churchmanship that is, Pastor Peterson, so very lacking in the church today.
Right. Well, and just like you were saying with that marvelous book on church growth, you know, he always was so incredibly good at dealing with the issues and speaking very clearly and directly, not playing games. I mean, he would name names. That is, you know, so that you could actually sort of check sources and see if these things are accurate. But he never did it in a way that was personal. He never engaged in really sort of abuse or what we maybe would call politics. I mean, that's the kind of churchmanship that he engaged in. And he always embraced and encouraged freedom in the gospel. He was never a legalist in any way. So even though, like I say, his preference was certainly for a sort of high liturgical practice, he would never allow any kind of legalism to come in.
Two final questions then, Pastor Peterson. We on a regular occasion here on this program remember the saints of old, you know, those who have gone before us centuries and millennia in the past, and I wonder if you could put this remembrance of Kurt Marquardt on his passing in that context, even though he's not a saint of old, he's a saint of recent memory, we would say.
Absolutely. And we should be comforted by the reality that Kurt Marquardt prays for us, that he is like unto those that were seen by St. John in Revelation chapter 4 under the altar, praying, how long, O Lord, wanting God to bring things to completion. And we prayed for Kurt Marquardt for a long time, and we no longer are praying for him. He has come to his reward, but he still is praying for us, and he is still in fellowship with us. There is only one church, so we should take great comfort in that.
Among all the things he wrote, his years of teaching, his influence on generations of pastors who serve now faithfully at pulpits and altars in our church, what will be Dr. Kurt Marquardt's greatest legacy, do you think, Pastor Peterson?
I think he would say that it is just that. I think he would say that it was his students. I noticed in the book that he wrote, as you say, he wrote so many things, but the book he wrote entitled The Church for the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics, that he dedicated that to the ministerium, that is, the pastors of the Missouri Synod. And, of course, teaching in a seminary is preparing pastors. And I think that's where he would see his legacy, not only in the Missouri Synod, but, as you mentioned, also in Haiti, in Africa, in Russia, I mean, really all over the world.
Pastor David Peterson is pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Very early this morning, one of his parishioners and a regular guest here on the program, Dr. Kurt Marquardt, entered his eternal rest, and Dr. Marquardt was a member there at Redeemer Lutheran Church. If you would, pass along our sincerest condolences and peace to the Marquardt family. And God's blessings on you as the pastor as you preside over the funeral for Dr. Kurt Marquardt.
Thank you very much. I'll be sure to tell them that.
Well, it will be a tremendous loss, not only to Redeemer and to the church, but I think especially to Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, hear the passing of Dr. Kurt Marquardt, a voice that was so much needed, perhaps not heeded sufficiently, I would say, but certainly only silenced here, teaching until Friday. That's amazing. Only silenced here so that he could open his mouth in eternity and sing the praises of Jesus Christ and behold him face to face. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, even suffering this loss, nevertheless will continue to do and to honor the legacy of Dr. Marquardt by continuing to teach pastors with that faithful, scriptural, and gospel, Christ-centered, cross-focused, centered theology that the church so desperately continues to need. For more information about Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, you can call them toll-free, 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155, or you can find their logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Well, it's audio open lines for the remainder of the program today. We have got a long way to go, and I don't know if 90 minutes is going to be sufficient time to get every place we want to go. Starting out, an Episcopal church in Pasadena, California, is finding itself at the wrong end of the Internal Revenue Service. Here's the story from National Public Radio.
An Episcopal church in Pasadena, California, is in danger of losing its tax-exempt status. The IRS is looking into a sermon that was delivered there a few days before the 2004 election. The government thinks it may have violated the law requiring churches and nonprofit organizations to refrain from endorsing candidates. All Saints is a famously liberal church where parishioners expect their pastors to speak from the pulpit on the moral issues of the day. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
At the 11:15 Sunday service at All Saints Church, there was a buzz of anticipation, waiting for the Reverend Edwin Bacon to deliver his sermon. He faced an absolutely packed house.
I want to begin this sermon by once again expressing my gratitude to the Internal Revenue Service.
Many of those listening to this sermon had heard the other one that's gotten All Saints into hot water. It was delivered in late October 2004 by their retired pastor, George Regas. Cast as a debate between George Bush, John Kerry, and Jesus, it condemned many of the Bush administration's policies on the war and on poverty. Yesterday, Bacon told the congregation that this was fulfilling the duty of the church.
This church can neither be silent nor indifferent when there are public policies causing detriment to the least of these.
The IRS summons asks for 17 categories of documents: church policies, emails, church payroll, and other expenses relating to the sermon in question. And, said Bacon,
every instance in which we mention any elected official or candidate in our worship. Since we pray for President Bush by name Sunday after Sunday.
There are two ways to respond to the IRS summons, said Bacon. Comply with the agency's request or refuse and argue their case before a judge.
We would argue that this entire case has been an intrusion, in fact an attack, upon this church's First Amendment rights to the exercise of freedom of religion and freedom of speech.
The entire congregation stood. The applause lasted a full minute.
I think I get your drift.
The timing of the IRS summons is another cause for concern, says Douglas Laycock, a professor of constitutional law at the University of Michigan.
This summons, 2 months before the election, is a message to everybody else out there. You guys better be quiet this election season, or this might happen to you.
A church's loss of tax-exempt status, says Laycock, doesn't just affect the church. It affects the parishioners as well.
Everybody who contributed to that church and took a tax deduction for their contributions is now subject to audit and having those deductions rolled back.
The investigation into All Saints Church is, quote, bewildering, according to Barry Lynn, head of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State.
Many churches that I believe went far, far over the line in the last election cycle apparently aren't being investigated anymore at all.
Well, no one knows that for sure, says IRS Commissioner Steve Miller, who oversees tax-exempt organizations.
Because of the law, we're unable to speak to specific cases. That's for taxpayer protection.
Which means he couldn't comment on the All Saints Church case either. But he did acknowledge that since the last election, the IRS has stepped up education and enforcement.
We saw a lot of money flowing into campaign coffers and became a little concerned that things might be getting out of hand.
All Saints Church, however, has been taking on social causes for decades, opposing the wars in Iraq and Vietnam, working for civil rights, and opposing the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. Now it has another battle on its hands, but this time it's not one of the church's choosing. Ina Jaffe, NPR News, Los Angeles.
All right, there's a story from National Public Radio. Now, a couple things we need to note here, and I want to hear from you on this. What's your reaction to the fact that here a church on the religious and political left is being examined out there in Pasadena, California by the IRS for having violated the tax code. In other words, if you want your tax-exempt status, the church will not be used as a platform for particular parties or candidates. That's how the tax code more or less grants the privilege of, and it is a privilege, by the way. Remember, there's nothing in the Bible says churches shouldn't pay taxes. That's how the IRS grants the privilege of tax-exempt status. You don't advocate for particular parties or candidates. So what do you make of it? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's audio open lines for the remainder of Issues Etc. today. And we're coming to you live this Tuesday. It's the 19th of September. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. I guess the one thing we need to note here is that this is about advocating for or against candidates and not, as the end of the story seemed to indicate, social causes. Social causes are not a concern of the IRS. What they're concerned about is politicking from a church. Now, a church is free to politic as long as it pays taxes. But if it wants the privilege of a tax-exempt status, then it won't politic for parties or candidates. Before we go to our break, let's talk with DB, who calls from his car. DB, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hey, Todd. You've already touched on the two points I was going to mention, but I was going to say just that tax exemption is not something that's guaranteed us through Scripture or anything else, and so I don't see how taking away a tax-exempt status really impedes our right to the freedom of expression, freedom of religion, freedom of speech. In addition to that, before I actually heard the context of the story, I thought it was going to be a story about the right-wing movement in the church. And I'm politically conservative myself, but have always been very uncomfortable with the church pulpit being used to promote political candidates rather than the gospel of Christ. And so I already had taken a position that it was wrong, and it's interesting to hear, though, it's a liberal church in that position. So.
Oh, yes, DB, thank you very much. You're quite right. If you didn't know that it was a church on the religious and political left, and if you didn't listen very carefully to the story, you would have thought you were listening to a pastor from a church on the political right. They're kind of squealing just like the stuck pig. Hey, you're infringing on our religious freedom. Isn't it interesting the arguments on the religious left when it comes to this are exactly like the arguments on the religious right? And that both seem to, I don't know what to call it, but flaunt the regulations of our tax system. And say, hey, now, you don't hear them saying, hey, take away our tax-exempt status. We're going to do this as a matter of principle. That I would respect. But to say, hey, we want to be able to flaunt the tax code and still enjoy the privilege of tax-exempt status, that's a harder case to make. Maybe you disagree. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Email us here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. When we come back from this break, a brief excerpt from President Bush's speech given to the General Assembly of the United Nations this morning in New York. He had a few things to say about whether or not the United States is at war with Islam. Stay tuned. Audio Open Lines continues after this.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
What makes this such a unique place is that the Word of God is so central and is proclaimed with such vigor and such clarity at this place.
Dr. Larry Rast on the uniqueness of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Here the Scriptures are at the center. The Lutheran Confessions, as a right exposition of the Scriptures, are held up for all the world to hear. Here we are concerned about our historical past and being faithful to the proclamation of the gospel as the Scriptures give them to us and as the faithful church has delivered those over time. And also we are concerned about preparing servants for the church, pastors who will preach the word and administer the sacrament. So what you have is a community with Christ at the center of all things. And as such, that truly makes this a unique place.
Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Americans United is warning churches that they could get in trouble with the IRS if they get involved in politics. That includes voter guides that many churches pass out close to the election. But pro-family groups say Americans United is more concerned that millions of evangelical voters will turn out in November and accuses them of trying to intimidate pastors. Kim Troby has more.
The only thing that churches cannot do or endorse or oppose candidates for public office.
That's Barry Lynn with Americans United. He warns the IRS is going to be paying special attention to nonprofits during the election and will respond swiftly to violations.
They need to be very careful about Internal Revenue Service scrutiny of their electoral activities.
His beef is with voter guides. He claims most of them are biased in favor of Republicans and constitute a great infringement on campaign law. Rick Scarborough with Vision America disagrees. He says 5 million evangelical voters didn't show up for the last election. Lynn and others want it to stay that way.
Their tactic is to intimidate. Their tactic is to create fear among the clergy. What we need in the pulpit are more courageous men who will stand up and speak out regardless of the intimidation.
Scarborough says the best way to get the word out is for pastors to address politics from the pulpit and persuade their members to register and vote.
We've got to encourage our preachers to get informed on these issues and bring to bear biblical teaching on them.
Lynn was especially critical of Focus on the Family's 8-state campaign to get voter guides into the hands of constituents. For Family News in Focus, I'm Kim Troby.
States in the Focus on the Family campaign include Pennsylvania, Maryland, Michigan, Ohio, New Jersey, Minnesota, and Tennessee. Americans United will be contacting churches in those states and a few others, discouraging pastors from getting involved in politics. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO. Join Paul Clayton and me, Diane Summers. We talk with Consumer Reports on the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration's proposal about electronic stability control on light cars and trucks. And also we'll talk with Fred Librand about how to be a good writer. It begins at 11:05, Living Jubilee, on AM 850 KFUO.
Our Issues Etc. book of the month for September is actually a CD and a booklet. It's titled Listening to Luther. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. The CD contains a recording of Luther's Small Catechism and hymns by Martin Luther. The booklet contains a history of the Small Catechism and several of Martin Luther's hymns, including the text. Listening to Luther, our Issues Etc. book of the month.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we're going to continue our weekly series on teaching a Sunday school lesson with Pam Nielsen, Deaconess Pam Nielsen of Concordia Publishing House. Also tomorrow, Cain and Abel is going to be the subject during that particular part of our series. We went from creation to the fall into sin, and then Cain and Abel. If you notice something about the series on the Sunday, on teaching a Sunday school lesson, you don't have to pack it all in. And, you know, a lot of Sunday school lessons would try to get all of Genesis in a couple of weeks. No, move slowly because this stuff is important. Also tomorrow, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery has been kind enough to agree to join us to talk about the Pope's remarks on Islam, the treatment of detainees by the U.S., that whole torture issue upon which I hear that this morning the Bush administration's modifying its position, and then also something mentioned by the president today when he was speaking at the U.N., the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. Now, the president had that to talk about. The main theme of his UN speech was, of course, to ensure universal human rights. The U.S. is acting the way that it has been acting during his administration. He was countering some criticism there as well. I don't think you could call the UN Assembly the president's crowd. I think that's probably pretty safe. But he did have something interesting to me that he said, and it had to do with Islam, and it had to do with whether or not the United States is at war with Islam. Here's just a little piece of the president's address to the General Assembly of the UN this morning in New York.
So we must stand with democratic leaders and moderate reformers across the broader Middle East. We must give them voice to the hopes of decent men and women who want for their children the same thing we want for ours. We must seek stability through a free and just Middle East, where the extremists are marginalized by millions of citizens in control of their own destinies. Today, I'd like to speak directly to the people across the broader Middle East. My country desires peace. Extremists in your midst spread propaganda claiming that the West is engaged in a war against Islam. This propaganda is false, and its purpose is to confuse you and justify acts of terror. We respect Islam, but we will protect our people from those who pervert Islam to sow death and destruction. Our goal is to help you build a more tolerant and hopeful society that honors people of all faiths and promotes the peace.
All right, there are the president's words. Those caught my attention when I was listening to his address this morning on the radio. I wonder if they catch yours as well. This is one of those cases, I'll be honest with you, where I say yes, and then part of me also says no. And I'll play some of that out for you here in the course of Audio Open Lines. I want to hear your thoughts on it, too. What did you make of the president's bold statement? He says, I want to speak to the people of the Middle East. You've been told by radical elements in your midst that the U.S. is engaged in a war against Islam. It's simply not true. It's propaganda. They're trying to deceive you. All we want is for freedom and democracy to flourish so that all religions can be respected even in the Middle East. The big question I have, the no part of my reaction is that possible if Islam holds sway? A respect for all religions in the Middle East. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Issuesetc@kfuo.org. Now, you cannot declare war on a religion. So, for someone to say America is at war with Islam, in some senses, yes, it is false. In the same way, we'd say, is America at war with terrorism? Well, terrorism is a means to an end. Terrorism is a way of conducting war. It's a tactic. It's not an entity with which you can make war. So I guess by the same logic, we'd say we're not engaged in a war against terrorism either, which the president has, by the way, said consistently since September 2001 that we're in a war against terrorism. What I wonder about here is, can you separate Islam, can you take it and isolate it from what the U.S. and other countries are trying to do in the Middle East? Can you ignore it as a factor? I wouldn't be concerned at all about the president's statement there before the U.N., except for the fact that if he would have said something, and tell me if you think I'm wrong, please, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. If he would have said something like, no, we're not in a war against Islam, however, you can't ignore Islam when we engage in the war that we are in. You can't ignore the religious factor, which is Islam. And then that big question mark looms, which is, if Islam does hold sway, and we respect Islam, and we're not at war trying to eradicate Islam as a religion, if Islam holds sway in the Middle East, can the president's stated goal there before the UN of having societies that respect all religions and keep the peace, can that be achieved? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's Audio Open Lines. We're coming to you live this Tuesday, the 19th of September. Our in-studio email address, feel free to use it, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Up first during this hour, Mark is calling from his car. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, hello.
What's your question or comment?
Well, I would like to believe that what the president says is true, that we're not in a war against Islam. That may be what we'd like to believe or what our national leaders believe. But that may not be the case, given everything that is happening in the world and looking at the history of Islam. You've had Dr. Al Schmidt on your program a few times, And it would seem that, you know, that's certainly not Dr. Schmidt's opinion, that true Islam wants to spread the message of Islam by the sword, and that's what the Pope wanted to question too.
Thank you very much, Mark. Those are some of my concerns as well. It's not a question, is are Muslims the enemy? No, because of course not all Muslims are the enemy. Not all Muslims are engaged in warfare against the United States or against the West. The question is Islam the problem? Is it the source of these things? I mean, people are altogether comfortable with saying, no, the source of terrorism, you know, people on the left will say, the source of terrorism is the fact that the U.S. went into the Middle East and started stirring things up, or the fact that U.S. has been supporting Israel for so many years. That's the source of terrorism. If that weren't there, then terrorism would dry up and blow away. People are comfortable, many are, with that kind of thinking. Well, what about asking the question, is Islam itself, in the context of the Middle East, when it holds political power as it does, is it the genesis of that kind of terrorism? And in that case, you simply can't ignore it. You can't say, well, Islam is beside the point. Dennis calls from his car. Hi, Dennis. Thanks for waiting.
Hello, Pastor Todd.
Hello.
Thank you for taking my call today.
Happy to do it.
This is a very difficult question to address, because in certain, I suppose, quarters of Islam, if you go back to 1979 when Khomeini took over Iran in the Iranian Revolution, they were certainly against the United States. I mean, they were declaring war on the United States when they took all those hostages from the United States embassy and the soldiers. I think that was the beginning of what one might call the war on terrorism, or the war on Islam that had been declared on the United States and Israel, because they. There is no monolithic Islam, but as you stated, there are, those governments that are controlling, that are controlled by Islamic regimes, and they certainly have declared war on the United States and Israel.
Thank you very much, Dennis. I think you rightly state the dilemma here in making a statement like, well, we are not at war. We are not. This is not a war against Islam. Again, as I said before, in one sense, it's quite true. In another sense, given the fact of the situation on the ground in the Middle East, it is true. I mean, sorry, it isn't true. You cannot divorce the two. If you can, I wish there was a way to do it. I really do. Greg's calling from his car. Greg, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Pat.
Hi.
I'm wondering if the real question is, is Islam at war with Christianity? And if it is, what's the obvious implication of that? I was wondering if I could get your comment on that.
Well, okay, I'm comfortable and uncomfortable with that, and let me explain myself. If we're talking about the president speaking as the representative of the United States and maybe even of Western powers, I'm not comfortable with that statement. Because Christianity and Western powers, or Christianity in the United States, or Christianity in the Bush administration, are not the same thing. I don't think the president was attempting to speak as a Christian president, but simply as the president when he spoke there before the UN. So if the question is intended to equate America with Christianity, from our side, I don't think it makes a lot of sense. However, from the Islamic side, they do often, radical Islam certainly, and perhaps most of Muslims in the world, do see an equal sign between Christendom and America. Are they right in that? No, of course they're not. But from their perspective, Christendom and America are the same thing. So if you were to say to them, are you at war with America? They might say yes. And then if you asked, are you at war with Christianity? They might say, you just asked me that. I said yes. Objectively, is Islam as a religious system hostile to Christianity? As a religious system? Absolutely. Oh, and by the way, Christianity is hostile to Islam. Christianity is hostile to all false teaching. Not just Oh, let's not talk about that false teaching. Christianity views false teaching, Orthodox Christianity views false teaching as the enemy, as an enemy and a danger. When Paul says we are not fighting against flesh and blood, but against powers, principalities, and unseen things, he's not only talking about angelic forces out there in the spiritual realm, he's talking about the way these things, these evils are manifested among us. False teaching. Jesus says, beware of false teachers. In the same way that you might, if you send your kids out into the neighborhood to play, say, beware of pedophiles. They're not good. Don't take candy from strangers is another way of Jesus saying, beware of false teachers. They're not just a neutral thing out there. They're a danger, an active, clear, present danger. So what, look, to be fair, is Islam hostile to Christianity? Yes, it should be. The two are incompatible. Is Christianity hostile? Not in dropping bombs sense, but ideologically, as a theology, hostile to Islam? Of course it is. The two teach mutually exclusive things. The fact that Christians, so many Christians, can't see that today makes one wonder whether they really know what they believe or are supposed to believe. It's Audio Open Lines this Tuesday, September the 19th. Join us with a question or a comment. We're talking about the president's statement before the UN this morning in New York, where he said, we are most definitely not engaged in a war against Islam. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. That in-studio email address, again, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Well, the fallout, not the president this time, but of course the Pope, another world leader. I wonder whether they modified the president's speech before the UN after Pope Benedict said what he said last week and there was this kind of reaction. I wonder if that line about a war against Islam was inserted there just to be on the safe side, because when the Pope spoke last week and quoted a 14th century historical document from a Byzantine emperor about the nature of Islam in his day, well, there's still trouble. Here's an update on the story from CBS News on the Pope and his comments about Islam.
And this evening, the fury over what Pope Benedict said about Islam last week has still not died down. Despite 4 days of protests and an apology yesterday from the Pope, which many Muslims say was not enough. NBC News correspondent Keith Miller has our report tonight on the fresh anger and the new threats.
Muslim rage again today. An effigy of Pope Benedict burned along with the flags of the Vatican and America in southern Iraq. Protesters in Indonesia demanded a stronger apology from the Pope, calling him Satan. Iran's supreme leader called the Pope's remarks the latest chain of the crusade against Islam, started by Bush. And a group linked to Iraq's branch of Al-Qaeda posted this threat on a radical website. We shall break the cross and spill the wine. God will help to conquer Rome. God enable us to slit their throats. All of this, even after the Pope told his Sunday audience he was deeply sorry his remarks offended Muslims. The Pope saying the medieval text he quoted, linking Islam to violence, did not reflect his own opinions. It was the third time that the Vatican expressed regret. But the Muslim world wants more.
Now, the Muslims believe that they were actually targeted. They are humiliated by the West.
And angry enough to torch 6 churches in the West Bank in Gaza. But some say Benedict has done enough.
It's tantamount to madness to say that he should still be sort of held to account when he's apologized for offending Islam.
But there is still enough alarm for Italian police to raise the terrorist threat level. And the Vatican Secretary of State has ordered church officials to get in touch with Muslim governments to explain the Pope's position. Tonight, the Vatican says Benedict's visit to Muslim Turkey next month is still on. But with the Pope now a target of radical Islam, any decision to travel will be based on security. Keith Miller, NBC News, London.
All right. Yeah, apologies. That wasn't CBS. That was NBC. The if you thought this was going to go away, look, I admitted yesterday, I didn't even see this one coming. This one caught me by surprise over the weekend, even though we played a story and I commented briefly on the Pope's comments before all heck broke loose Thursday last week. We just played it and I thought, I didn't find anything in it to got the hair on the back of my neck standing up. But if you thought it was going to go away over the weekend, if it was just one of those weekend stories, it certainly is not. I wonder whether the Pope will be visiting Turkey. If he does, as we discussed yesterday with one of our guests, if he does, it's kind of a damned if you do and damned if you don't scenario for him. If he doesn't go, it might be viewed as a slight to this Islamic nation, a very mildly democratic Islamic nation Turkey is. If he goes, he might be viewed as pandering to Muslims that the rest of the Muslim world don't think are true Muslims, Turkish Muslims. If he's seen shaking hands or visiting with Muslim leaders there in Turkey, radical Islam might look in on that and say, look, the only Muslims he wants anything to do with are the ones who aren't truly Muslim in Turkey. So, look, the question is being forced, whether you're Pope Benedict XVI, or President Bush before the UN, the question is being forced. And sooner or later, it will have to be answered. How do we deal with Islam? Not the Islam that we wish existed in the world. Wouldn't it be great if all of them were members of CARE? If all of them were westernized Muslims? Wouldn't it be great? It would be. But let's deal with it as it is, rather than as we wish it would be. Well, here's one more cut on the fallout from Pope Benedict's remarks made last week on Islam.
For more here tonight on this fallout from the Pope's speech, we're fortunate to have our NBC News chief Middle East correspondent Richard Engel here with us in New York at our headquarters. And Richard, this, it's your position, this doesn't help a problem the Pope already had.
Absolutely, Brian. He was already very unpopular in the Middle East, unlike Pope John Paul II, who was seen as someone who was preaching peace and understanding and was embraced by many people across the Middle East. This Pope is seen as something of a hardliner who wants Europe to understand its Christian roots, to embrace them first, and that only after that a Christian identity has been encapsulated, that then there should be a dialogue with the Muslim world.
And in talking to you here today, you reminded us this was also a story that was exacerbated and accelerated by being in our internet age.
Absolutely. Most people in the Middle East are not following every speech that's given by the Pope. But time and time again, we've seen a relatively small incident like this one. First, there was the cartoons this summer, and before that, there was the incident of the Newsweek article that accused a guards at Guantanamo Bay of flushing a Koran down the toilet. A small group of radicals was able to use these issues, spread them around the world, and put them on the Muslim agenda.
By the way, it's good to talk to you in a safe and controlled setting for once. Richard Engel here with us in our New York studios tonight, our chief Middle Eastern correspondent.
All right, there's the update on the Pope and the latest on the fallout from it. As I said before, probably not going away anytime soon. I imagine that heightened security around Benedict XVI will stay in place indefinitely. There's one thing for sure. Look, we could find some sort of military genius or political genius to help us win the war on terrorism. But Islam will still be there. Now, if there's no relationship between Islam and terrorism, fine and good. Fine. Problem solved. But if there is a relationship between the two, to what degree then does the problem remain? Even though we may, as the president expressed so many times in his speech to the UN, push the radical elements everywhere to the margin by this great vast middle that he sees out there of peace-loving people, Muslim, Christian, atheist, all around the world. Maybe the question is this, one that I'm sure the president has struggled with. Peace always comes with terms, doesn't it? I mean, there's no such thing as peace without terms. If there's war, peace only comes with certain terms, usually dictated by the victor, sometimes by mutual consent. If there's going to be peace in the Middle East, who will dictate the terms and what will they be? And if it's Islam who demands on dictating the terms, will the cost of peace be? Let Islam take over and rule the Middle East the way we see it taking over and ruling in so many countries. Let's go back to the phones as our time winds down. In this second hour, Ann calls from St. Louis. Hi, Ann. Ann, welcome to Issues Etc. All right, let's see if we can talk with... Let's go to Steve, if we would, Charlie. We'll talk with Steve in Kirksville. Steve, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hello. I was just... Of course, we know that there's people that will take any bit and piece to of what somebody says to turn it to their own advantage to get a following. And I'm sure that's what's happened with this, with the Pope. I'm wondering why, if the Pope said something that some people are saying was taken entirely out of context, and I don't know that it was or wasn't, I haven't looked into that enough, why is not the mainstream America press investigating that and blowing that very loudly in an effort to try to create some world peace? And I'm just kind of curious why they just assume what he said. That's all I ever hear from them is this, he said this big inflammatory thing. I haven't heard anybody in mainstream media going, my goodness, let's see what he really said. I mean, the stakes are high.
Well, I agree, Steve, although I'm not going to lay the blame here at the press for this one, because you can go any place online to any news outlet, wherever they locate themselves on the political spectrum, you can find the full text of what the Pope had to say in English translation. That context is not missing. If you want to go find it, it's easily found out there. I don't think the Pope was taken out of context. Now, if you mean he was making an academic lecture rather than preaching a sermon, sure, he wasn't preaching a sermon. He was lecturing academics. And he said very clearly that whatever this Byzantine emperor had to say about Islam was not his personal, not necessarily his personal opinion. He had that disclaimer. The question is whether it's true or not. What this Byzantine emperor observed about Islam in his day, is it still true today? Ann calls from St. Louis. Hi, Ann. Our time is short.
I wanted to say that my take on Pope Benedict is that I don't think it was taken out of context. I think he did quote it. I think he knew exactly what he was saying. And you know what? I think he's right. And I think all the Islamics, or not, well, whoever the fringe groups are simply showing their true colors, and it's time for the moderate Islams, who we hear so much about, to speak out about this. And if he goes to Turkey, my bet is that he's willing to die. And then if they kill him, that'll really show what they're all about.
Thank you very much, Anne. Well, when we come back from this break, I'll comment on not only what Anne had to say there, but also on what the previous caller had to say as well. A couple notes here taken during the break. Our call-in numbers, audio open lines for the last hour of Issues Etc. We'll stay with this subject. Also, as time permits, we're going to hear about a pastor, a Baptist pastor, who's out there in the church giving lectures and seminars on what he calls hot Christian sex. Not just Christian sexuality, not just Christian marriage and procreation, but he says hot Christian sex. Christians should expect it to be hot. We'll hear some of that and get your reaction in the third hour.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.